It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Paralympics Games are going on this week in Sochi, Russia. We'll meet a Wisconsin man who's working on cross-country skiing for people with disabilities. But first, a new Gallup poll shows the rate of uninsured Americans is on track to be at the lowest level in years. The survey shows the number of uninsured people has dropped in almost every demographic group so far this year. The rate has dropped the most for people who are uninsured and make less than $36,000 a year. Tom Oliver is with us to discuss this news and whether or not it can be chalked up to the Affordable Care Act. He's a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and director of the Master of Public Health program at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So according to this poll, more people are signing up for health care as more parts of the Affordable Care Act come into practice now. Is there a connection? Did the Affordable Care Act lead more people to be insured?
I think the Affordable Care Act is part of the good news here. Clearly, the economy has been on a slower than desired, but still positive direction for the last few years, and that certainly has brought more people opportunities to have jobs and either pay for their own health benefits or get them through their employment. But there's no question that the news of just in the last month that there's been an uptick in enrollment is almost certainly directly attributable to expansion of Medicaid eligibility in state programs and also folks being able to sign up through the health insurance exchanges, both in the states and those sponsored by the federal government.
So looking at that Gallup poll anyway, still over 15% of Americans are uninsured. Sounds like a lot. Did we expect more people to have coverage by now?
We're expecting, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan so-called scorekeeper of health reform, to see about 7 million people sign up in the first year of the Affordable Care Act's full implementation, which is this year. And so we're well on our way to that, but still about 4 million folks have signed up for health insurance coverage that didn't have it. So we still have a little bit of a gap, and that's probably due to a combination of things. The fiasco around the startup of the federal government health insurance exchanges, healthcare.gov website that we heard much about in the late fall, and also some confusion, and also the fact that you're not required to sign up for insurance until the end of this month, March, before any financial penalties would kick in.
We've seen, in addition to that rocky start of the website, bumping back the deadlines for different groups of employers to have to provide coverage. Is that a sign of poor planning or just a bigger problem that planners thought they had to tackle from the outset?
It's a good question, exactly what the reasons for these delays. They're certainly, some of them are being attributable to politics and electioneering. On the other hand, I think we've seen that this is such a complicated reform that when you're trying to expand private insurance and public insurance options at the same time in different parts of the market and set different rules for each part of that market, that you're not getting it all right at the same time. And so I think some of them are just simply being realistic and wanting to be sure that people don't experience gaps in coverage simply because they or their employers were caught in between, good opportunities to keep their coverage or get new and better improved coverage.
And also on the theme of extensions, the administration announced last week it would allow health insurers to renew plans that aren't currently compliant with the Affordable Care Act for another 2 years to avoid a whole bunch of people dropping off of policies at once, I guess. Was that a good call, or would we have seen this big rush of people without coverage?
It's hard to know what would have happened, and I think I would actually give a little bit of credence to critics who are saying that the administration is picking and choosing different provisions of the legislation in terms of enforcing its implementation. What is not good policy to give people a chance to stay on coverage that has very, very thin benefits. nothing like the coverage that they would be given through the exchanges or other options. So people who keep those plans will not have great coverage typically, or will be liable for very, very large contributions towards that coverage. On the other hand, it avoids a lot of people being confused or not being quite aware where to look for those better options. So I think the problem is that we haven't had as strong an opportunity to get out the message about opportunities for enrollment, had a great outreach as we saw many years ago with the Children's Health Insurance Program. And so it's been a little bit of a struggle, and the message that the public is receiving is a little bit complex and confusing.
Well, speaking of outreach, here's a clip of President Obama on Zach Galifianakis's semi-serious talk show, Between Two Ferns. The president was there to put in a plug for the health care plan.
What we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
So there's the president in a venue reaching out to younger Americans with a message targeted toward younger people. How important is that to the success of the Affordable Care Act, getting younger people to sign up?
Well, it's really important from the sheer perspective of we want a broad risk pool, so to speak. We need young people and healthier people in the pool because that both lowers the average costs of health insurance, but it also gives insurance companies a chance to lower what we call the risk premium that's added on top, the uncertainty that they have that they might have to pay out more in healthcare costs than the premiums coming in the door. And so we all benefit with lower healthcare costs, the more of us that are in the insurance pool. The thing is, we've had dramatic success with many parts of the Affordable Care Act. Remember, the full name of it was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And the patient protections are the things that are by far the most popular with Americans. You don't have lifetime limits to your insurance coverage. You can't be kicked off because you got sick and cost the insurance company a lot of money. You can't be kicked out because somebody found an error in your application, including a typo or something that allows them to invalidate it. And for young people, the key provision was that you could stay on your family's health coverage if that was desirable in terms of cost or the quality of coverage. And so millions of young Americans have been able to either gain or maintain their coverage through that key provision of the Affordable Care Act.
We've seen some analysis that Wisconsin, as far as people who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act goes, is among the oldest in the country. Us, and I think it was West Virginia, had an older population signing up, not as many young people. Is that a worry on a state-by-state basis?
I think it depends on how we see things playing out over the next year or two. We've had a slower rollout of the Affordable Care Act provisions because Wisconsin did not expand its own Medicaid program to the fullest extent possible under the law, and it is a little slow in getting its health insurance exchange up and running compared to some of the other states that actually launched well ahead of the formal deadline this winter. So I think we're going to have to see how that plays out. But it wouldn't necessarily be that surprising given the large number of manufacturing jobs that were lost in the Great Recession and have not been reclaimed. Those tended to come with good insurance and good salaries or wages that would allow people to buy coverage. So we may be seeing a lagged effect of our overall economic performance in the health insurance enrollment numbers so far.
Looking ahead, are we going to see something close to full coverage in our country?
Actually, and that's probably the single most misleading part of the Affordable Care Act, as people understand it. It was not designed to actually give us universal coverage. We were always going to have, even in the best scenario, about 20 to 30 million people still uninsured. On the other hand, about 30 million or more were going to gain insurance coverage. So it's a half a loaf approach, but it's a huge step forward, and it really sets up the opportunity to keep expanding towards universal coverage. If our economy improves, if our the politics around healthcare reform settle down, and we get back to the question of what do people really need, and what are we willing to do as a country to ensure that there's adequate health care. And we learn that, as we see the numbers roll out, that paying now is better than paying later for an awful lot of health care problems. And I would say, Rob, the good news, the really good news of the Affordable Care Act and health care reform in general, is that we've had by far the greatest slowdown in health care spending in a generation or two. Over the last 30 years, we had annual increases of about 7% or more in our nation's health care bill. The last 4 years, we've had 3% to 3.5%.
We'll leave it there. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
That's Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about a new poll showing the rate of uninsured Americans is on track to be the lowest it's been in years. The Winter Olympics were in Sochi, Russia earlier this year. Now another important Olympics event is going on this week, the 2014 Paralympics. To update us on the Paralympics, they started on March 7th, running through the 16th. We have Yuri Gusev. He's athletic director for the Central Cross Country Ski Association in Verona. Yuri got involved with adaptive cross-country skiing 10 years ago. Since then, he's introduced over 1,000 people with physical disabilities and visual impairment to Nordic skiing, a big Wisconsin tradition. He's also helped train 4 American athletes currently taking part in those games in Sochi. Yuri, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having us at the show.
Well, I bet you're watching the games closely. Can you give an update on how American athletes are doing there?
I think they're doing pretty well and had some close performances to the medal, and we had the first female silver medal for the United States. So I think it's pretty exciting for the team and for everyone.
Well, I use the phrase adaptive cross-country skiing. What is that?
Adaptive cross-country skiing, that's cross-country skiing for individuals with physical disabilities and visual impairment or blindness. So it covers, all pretty much ranges.
And how do you train people to do that? What's the training process like for somebody, say, with physical disabilities or visual impairments to get started?
It's actually pretty similar to able-bodied individuals. Obviously, depends on the disability. They have equipment would be different in some cases. In some cases, it will be exactly the same. So the first step typically is to find out what type of equipment, adaptable type of equipment we need to use so someone can participate.
So someone doesn't have arms or legs. How do you make the equipment work for that person?
For example, if someone missing both legs, in that case, we would use a sit ski. It's a chair that get clamped to the skis, and they'll propel. The skier will propel with the poles, just like normal cross country skiing. If someone missing an arm or both arms or part of the arm, so they will use exactly the same skis, and they will ski with one pole, Sometimes, if it's, for example, below knee amputee, for example, we had an athlete, Dan Perkins, so he was just using the part of prosthetic leg, and he was using just the same equipment, skis and poles. And for visually impaired or blind athletes, the same. It's the same equipment, skis and poles. They just need to ski with the guide.
With that specialized equipment, this isn't something I imagine you can just pop into a store and buy. Is it being specially built for people?
Definitely. When we have to, if a skier needs to use a sit ski, Yes, it's a special equipment, a chair, again, built based on someone's disability. And, for example, we developed, with the help of partners, we developed equipment that is adjustable based on disability. So this way we virtually can use it for, really, for individuals with any physical disabilities. We can fit them in that chair.
And I understand in the past you've kind of had to make something for each individual to fit them, but you're working with some UW engineers to get adaptable frames. Is that right?
Yes. When we just started with the program and we purchased the first sit ski, we learned quickly that it was built custom for someone. So for us, the big question was, how can we take that piece of equipment and use it for anyone with different disabilities? And at that time, we got involved with the engineering department in UW-Madison and worked with students to develop a sit ski that actually has adjustable pieces to it, so we can actually fit them based on someone's disability.
Now, you've worked with hundreds of people there on cross-country skiing, and I imagine a lot of them with various disabilities wouldn't have thought they'd ever be able to do something like cross-country skiing. What's the response once they get out there and they hit the trails and they're actually out there skiing?
Oh, they love it. And a lot of people we see that maybe they got injured later or had an injury, and they never knew that there's even possible to cross-country ski if they, for example, had an accident. And once they get on snow on the skis, it's a pretty incredible feeling. And, you know, just like feeling, you know, skiing for the first time and feeling you have on sliding on snow for the first time, it's a pretty incredible feeling. And for people that learn that there is, again, opportunity for them to ski with a family or with friends by themselves and go outdoor and enjoy outdoor and do recreation, people definitely have very incredible experiences.
And then how common is it for someone to start off doing this for fun, recreation, exercise, and then decide, hey, I want to go to the next level and compete?
There are people that have motivation to compete, and they want to do the best they can. From our standpoint, first, we want to introduce them to the sport and have them enjoy it. And if they decide that they want to do something more, even just competing at the local events, we have many individuals going to American Birkebeiner, and there are some other events around the state and in Midwest that provide opportunity to participate and compete in their events if they're adaptive skiers. So a lot of people just go and participate in the citizen level events, and if there are any that are interested to compete at the higher level, we definitely have resources for them do that.
And Yuri, I hear you've got a sneak preview for us. There's going to be an announcement in a couple days at the Sochi Paralympics about Wisconsin. Can you share the news with us?
Yes. Yeah, so it's very exciting. It will be a very exciting event for us at that level. It's World Championships is just a step below from Paralympic Games, so we'll see the best athletes from around the world. And again, announcement will be in a couple days made in Sochi. And I hope we can have people to come and watch and cheer for Team USA and for U.S. athletes.
And that the Paralympic World Championships you mentioned are going to be here in Wisconsin?
In Cable, Wisconsin, correct.
Cable, Wisconsin. And you played a role in helping make that happen, I gather.
Yeah. We hosted two World Cup events first. That was our first step in 2012 and 2013. And all the countries loved northern Wisconsin and the communities up north. And we got awarded to host World Championships.
How exciting is that for you, being someone who's really put our state on the map in adaptive cross-country skiing?
Well, it's definitely very, very rewarding event to have, and there will be a lot of people involved to make sure it goes well, and we're all very excited to produce the best event we can for the athletes to showcase Wisconsin and special Northern Wisconsin.
And just briefly, people can get involved as participants in adaptive cross-country skiing or volunteers. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
The best way probably would be to go to Cable Chamber of Commerce website, and as soon as the announcement is made, we'll have links to the event and volunteer sign up and schedule of the events so people can come and observe and spectate the events on the Chamber of Commerce website and cable.
Yuri, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Yuri Gusev, Athletic Director for Central Cross Country Ski Association in Verona, talking about adaptive cross-country skiing and the Paralympics. It's been nearly 40 years since a movie character and fictional news anchor took to the airwaves to express his anger, and the sentiment he expressed is one many people relate to today. Let's take a listen.
So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
That's Howard Beale, the fictional news anchor for the 1976 film Network, a satirical look at media corporations and television news. At the same time, it's been seen as maybe an eerily accurate prediction of what was to come in the decades that followed. Our next guest says that such a movie rarely gets made anymore. One man's vision of the world, independent of studio testing or market research. In a new book, he tells the story of Paddy Chayefsky, the man behind Network, as well as how the movie got made, its lasting impact, and how the movie's vision panned out in the media landscape. Joining us now is Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture reporter at the New York Times, and his new book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with that famous bit from the movie we just played there. If you could count up all the times it's been quoted, misquoted, paraphrased, and parodied, it's probably one of the most influential single lines in movie history. What is it about that that stuck with us and maybe still resonates today?
Sure. Well, you know, I think when the film was released in 1976, I mean, that moment and the language of the speech, all the things that, you know, Howard Beale is sort of rattling off about, you know, the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. I mean, those were very real issues that the country was going through. And I think there was a lot of repressed frustration going on at the time. And, the speech itself seemed to be saying, well, I mean, if you can't do anything else, at least you can get angry. That's a place to start. And, you know, certainly America has not calmed down very much in those past 40 years. Different issues, but plenty of things to be frustrated about. And so, you know, without maybe looking too deeply at what the speech is really saying, they're easy words to fall back on.
For people not familiar with the movie, let's bring them on board. Can you give us a synopsis of what it's all about?
Sure. So the story of the film is triggered by this television anchor, Howard Beale, who's played by the actor Peter Finch, who is working for a fourth place broadcast network in an era when there were really only three broadcast networks. The anchor is told that he's going to be fired, and so he threatens in the middle of one of his broadcasts to commit suicide on the air in a future show. And this sort of triggers a conflict within the network between its sort of old school news director, played by William Holden, who wants to make sure that Beale doesn't go on the air and continue to rant and rave, and between a sort of new generation of entertainment and programming executives, sort of specified or typified by a character played by Faye Dunaway, who very much wants to keep Beale out there, realizing that the angrier and more insane he gets, the better it is for the ratings of his show and for this declining network.
So Paddy Chayefsky wrote the movie, and it doesn't seem like this happens that often. This is a movie in the writer's voice, right? Usually if you want to be a writer and have the movie be yours and under your control, you have to be writer/director. How did he get this kind of influence over the movie he wrote?
Well, I mean, it was something that he had to build up over a span of, you know, nearly 20 years. People might remember him also as the writer of films like Marty, which,
great movie.
Of course, won, you know, the best picture Oscar and best screenwriter Oscar in 1955. But that was more of a kind of a personal drama, a story about, you know, a lonely butcher looking for love in the Bronx. And in the 20 years that followed, I mean, Chayefsky would continue to write those kinds of personal stories, you know, for film and for theater. But I think as his worldview expanded, as he became more aware of what was going on, I mean, he certainly felt a kind of obligation to take on, you know, broader topics in his writing. And certainly, I mean, he was always very concerned in his own career just about protecting his control over his work and his ability to make sure that, you know, what he put down on the page was what got onto the screen. And so, you know, I mean, he fought tooth and nail in a lot of scenarios to, you know, make sure that these the projects were handled the way he wanted, and would walk away from things if he felt that he couldn't get the autonomy that he felt he deserved. So, you know, by the time 1976 rolls around, he's definitely, you know, accrued a lot of power.
You looked at his notes, Chayefsky's notes, in the writing of this movie, and one thing you highlight is the thought, this movie doesn't have a voice or a perspective yet, but the one thing it had going in it was anger. Can you talk about this film as an expression of Paddy Chayefsky's anger?
Sure, sure. I mean, that was a document that he wrote to himself, you know, probably in 1974 or 75 as he's composing the script and kind of getting frustrated with himself. And, you know, I mean, he was such an amazing self-editor. I mean, not the kind of person who really shared a script with, you know, his producing partner or with a studio until he really felt it was done, at which point it was, okay, let's just roll the cameras. I'm not asking for your notes. But, you know, I mean, as I was saying earlier, I mean, there were a lot of things that frustrated him. I mean, in his private life, he certainly had a kind of fractious relationship with both his wife and his son, and kind of escaped into his work. And he was also kind of, you know, very politically attuned, and almost, you know, by the 1970s to a kind of paranoid degree. I mean, not only with what was happening in America, but around the world and in the Middle East. And, you know, so, I mean, all of these concerns and, you know, fears about, you know, corporate influence over media and you know, the ability of, you know, multinationals to buy up these corporations. I mean, all these things are kind of weighing upon him, and you know, he really feels he's got this duty to somehow tell one story that's going to get at every single one of these ideas. And it, I mean, it's quite a mammoth task, and yet, you know, he does almost kind of pull it off.
And this network anchor, Howard Beale, was in a way just expressing that same kind of raw anger. And on the other hand, he's a puppet of the corporations that Paddy Chayefsky was upset about. How much of Howard Beale was Paddy Chayefsky?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I mean, not the insane part, let's say. I mean, I think the movie draws a very clear distinction as to when Howard Beale, you know, loses his mind. And that the Mad as Hell speech actually comes after that. And there's as much Chayefsky in Howard Beale as there is in Max Schumacher, you know, the William Holden character, who, you know, as everybody else is running to their window and screaming, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, you know, there's Holden, you know, kind of sitting there shaking his head in despair and realizing that, you know, some kind of Rubicon has been crossed. And I think Chayefsky is there in that scene, too. I mean, he's seeing the rapid pace of technology, and especially communication technology, and realizing that, you know, the people by and large are not really thinking about, well, you know, how do I get my information, and you know, who do I trust to deliver it to me?
And Chayefsky actually created the network. This fictional network has a character. It had, what, a corporate structure and a full broadcast schedule, right?
That's right. I mean, and these are details that don't even really turn up in the movie. But before, you know, he felt that he could write the script, he felt that he had to kind of fully flesh out this whole operation. So he drew up for himself, you know, these whole, like, organizational charts with, you know, names and titles for, you know, every, you know, high-level employee at the company, and even made up a whole programming grid of what would have been airing on, you know, this fictional UBS channel at, like, every half hour of prime time. And, the, you know, these are things that, again, they don't, you know, you as viewers would never even see in the movie, but that he felt, you know, he had to have this information at his disposal to create this world.
You quote, I think it was Chayefsky's son, as saying, well, this wasn't really a satire of TV. It was TV here was a metaphor for society and the corporate world. It really seems like it's a satire of TV as you look at it and as you write about how much Chayefsky disliked the television landscape.
Well, I think that was certainly one major concern for him, or, you know, I mean, certainly one very strong motivating factor for him. But I think he did genuinely believe that it was telling a larger story about, you know, corruption and alienation. And that's, I mean, that's very present, you know, in the sort of, you know, the love triangle story among Holden and Faye Dunaway and Beatrice Strait, that, you know, Holden, you know, leaving his wife for this programming executive, even as she's trying to, you know, steal away his show. And that, you know, even when Holden dismisses Dunaway at the very end of the movie, when he tells her, you know, you're television incarnate, and, you know, he's there's a sort of a duality to that speech, that he's using all this language that could certainly apply to a human being, but is also very true of television. And so, you know, it's he's kind of blowing off both the person and the medium.
We're talking with Dave Itzkoff, author of Mad as Hell. It's about the making of the movie Network and the media future it portrayed. When we come back, we'll talk about whether it was prophetic, how much of what was in the movie is just part of everyday life here in the United States. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the film? Did it make you think and look at the different at the media in a different way? Where do you see the influence of Network in today's media, maybe in today's movies? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the 1976 movie Network, how it got made, and the media environment it portrayed. Dave Itzkoff is with us talking about his new book, Mad as Hell. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of the movie Network? Do you think it accurately portrayed, if not the media of the time, the mid-1970s? The media of our time. 800-642-1234 is the number. We have Charlie on the line with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I must say, Network is one of my favorite movies of all time. In fact, it came out when I was 7, and I've come to the movie several times and always come away at how fresh it is. I mean, from what was once Saudi Arabia could be Japan of the 90s, and which could be China today. The feminism issues that are brought up by Faye Dunaway are still as talked about now as they were back then, and the news media is totally entertainment. You see that now as it was becoming in the movie. I was just going to ask our guest, how did Patty think of it? Did he intend it to be as timeliness a movie as it is, because it's just fascinating. Even the terrorism issues
Charlie,
are brought up.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Dave, how did it stay so timely, he wonders.
Yeah, you know, I think you know, Chayefsky would probably give you a different answer depending upon, you know, what day of the week and what time of day you asked him. I think on some days, you know, he did see this as, you know, a very direct sort of comment on what he thought was going to happen to the media if people weren't more careful, that was sort of the intent of the film. And on other days, he might tell you, no, it was a, you know, I was aiming for something bigger and broader, and it's not just about television. But, you know, I at the risk of, you know, oversimplifying, I mean, I think, you know, he was just, you know, I mean, he was somebody who wasn't necessarily inclined to see the upside, or the, you know, the better side of humanity. That it wasn't hard for him to look at what was going on in his present day and just sort of, you know, to see it through a somewhat pessimistic lens, or you know, a skeptical lens, and just extrapolate a little bit that, you know, if we didn't you know, if we didn't you know, treat the subject of news with a kind of you know, dignity, that this is what was going to happen.
Charlie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dave, in your book, you write that Network, quoting here, provided a roadmap for the unraveling of the monolithic broadcasting companies, the diminishment of their once mighty news operations, and a path to a fragmented and unrecognizable media environment that the industry would follow almost to the letter over the next 40 years. Talk about how that has played out since the making of Network almost 40 years ago.
Sure. And I mean, again, remember that this is all happening in a three network landscape before, you know, cable TV or the internet even exists. But, you know, the sort of the central conflict that Chayefsky is envisioning between, let's say, the Holden and Dunaway characters is one between, you know, the news operation and the entertainment operation of a network. And that's exactly what happens by the 1980s, that the larger corporations that own these networks and the networks themselves are looking at the bottom lines. They're saying that, you know, news itself can't be a loss leader anymore. It can't, you know, just provide this public service and continue to lose money for, you know, for their parent companies. And so at that point, you know, news itself has to become profitable, and that's when it becomes entertainment. And that's exactly what what transpires. Of course, another big factor is, you know, the FCC relaxing its own equal time rules, and then that allows all kinds of opinion and to enter into the presentation of news, and that's when you get all these sort of latter day Howard Beale like figures on the airwaves.
We'll go to back to our phones now. We've got Tim on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Tim, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to mention that a relative of mine and his daughter were in that movie, and they played a part where the daughter asked the father if he thought they would really do it, and he says, go over to the window, open up the window, and listen. And that was my cousin Cindy, and she stuck her head out the window, and everyone's yelling, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it. And also, my uncle played the part when Howard Beale had his heart attack. My uncle came out, and he was the replacement newscaster. My uncle Stanley Grover.
Did he play the character named Jack Snowden? Was that his character?
It's been so long since the movie that I can't really remember. But he was the replacement newscaster. He was also in Independence Day, and he had a very tiny part in Dances with Wolves.
All right, Tim, thank you for bringing that up. And that reminds me, another prominent relative in that film, Walter Cronkite's daughter.
That's right. If people remember the film this well, there's a group of left-wing radical terrorists. One of the constituents is a woman named Mary Ann Gifford. She's supposed to be a sort of a play on Patty Hearst. And she was played by a young actress named Kathy Cronkite, who was indeed the daughter of Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite was a good friend of the network director, Sidney Lumet, and may have put in a good word for his daughter, may have helped her get hired there. It's also likely the filmmakers thought that was going to maybe inoculate them from some criticism, or at least, you know, the TV industry would think, hey, you know, they're in on the joke if, Cronkite's own daughter can participate in the film.
And Patty Chayefsky wrote an apology, right, to Walter Cronkite after the movie came out, or at least something saying, hey, this isn't about you?
Well, exactly. That, you know, in the run-up to the film, there was a tremendous pushback, from the TV news industry, that people were really kind of horrified by the film and offended by some of the ideas that it presented. And, you know, Cronkite was quoted in several of these news articles. And, you know, Chayefsky, who did not really easily apologize for anything, suddenly realizes that, you know, maybe he has gone too far, or at least, you know, hurt the feelings of, you know, thoughtful people whose, you know, help he needed to gain access to, you know, research his movie. And so, you know, he writes to Cronkite and also to John Chancellor just to say, hey, you know, I never meant this movie as an attack on you or your business.
Back to our callers now. We've got Lynn on the line in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, good afternoon. It's media, it seems, that now is open to the highest bidder. All forms, print, the news, television and radio. I know in the 40s and 50s during the Cold War and early 60s during the Cold War era that Hollywood kind of pretty much pandered to the right, and it seems we're doing the same thing again. And one of the epithets that we use here in my home is, well, you must get your news from Fox.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Do you think, I mean, Patty Chayefsky passed away in the early 80s, I think it was. Would he agree with Lynn?
Well, you know, I think he would certainly agree with the assessment that, you know, I mean, that media definitely, you know, it towed a certain line, you know, in the post-World War II era. And, you know, I mean, it was fortunate there was a sort of great flourishing of, you know, mainstream filmmaking that, you know, was willing to tackle some very tough issues, some very controversial issues, you know, Network being just one of several films the same year, you know, All the President's Men came out and Marathon Man. I mean, very kind of, you know, suspicious and paranoid films. The news environment that followed, I think, would almost certainly horrify Chayefsky, but I think he'd also be pretty horrified by, say, the internet or even something like Twitter, where a bunch of us can just go to our electronic windows and shout out whatever we want and just, you know, create our own little electronic cacophonies in the same way that Howard Beale did.
You talked to a number of journalists and media personalities about Network, including, speaking of Fox News, Bill O'Reilly. What did he make of Network and what it meant today?
Well, you know, I think, understandably, he is reluctant to identify himself with Howard Beale or cite Beale as an inspiration. But, you know, I thought he had a very astute assessment of the movie, that, you know, he also read it as a kind of indictment, not only on news and broadcasters, but on audiences mm-hmm. and on people who aren't so, you know, careful about what they watch. And I think that there is a lot of truth there. Certainly, if you watch the movie, you look at, you know, what the sort of circus that the Howard Beale show turns into at the very end, and that has as much to do with that that studio audience that's in attendance and just kind of, you know, miming whatever Howard Beale tells them to do. And I think that's you know, for O'Reilly to sort of connect those dots, I thought that was very perceptive of him.
And then there's Glenn Beck, who has compared himself to Howard Beale.
That's right. he has cited Howard Beale as an inspiration. And, you know, Stephen Colbert, in this book, he points out, you know, he says that, you know, Beck has cited the inspiration of people like, you know, Jesus and Gandhi and Howard Beale. And he adds, well, you know, none of those stories end well.
You know, going back, one of our earlier callers said it's still a good movie to watch. Is it? Is it still a fun movie to watch? It's been forever. Would it has some of it dated? Is it not aged well?
I know. You know. I mean, of course, I'm biased here because I wrote a book on the subject. But I'm happy to say, I mean, we've had a few screenings of the movie, you know, in conjunction with different events that I've done, and it seems like it's playing, you know, just as well as it would have in 1976. People are laughing at all, you know, all the lines that Paddy Chayefsky meant for them to find funny. But I think there's also a kind of a gallows humor that accompanies it now. That there are parts of the movie that we watch and we realize, well, this is just, you know, standard operating procedure for television now. And there's a kind of a dark humor in that we see. We're seeing a message that wasn't heeded, and you know, now we're living with the results of that.
We'll leave it there. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was Dave Itzkoff. He's culture reporter for the New York Times. His new book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. You can share your thoughts if you've watched Network lately on the Central Time Facebook page, and if you think it accurately predicted our media landscape today. Coming up next, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joins the show to share his thoughts on the third anniversary of Governor Walker signing his budget repair bill into law as part of our week-long series on Act 10.